Connecticut Democrats, or Connecticrats, as they have never been called.
Welcome back to Connecticrats. My name is David Kostek.
And I'm Tara Kamen.
And this is the podcast of the Connecticut Democratic Party. Well, we had our presidential primary this week, and it was the earliest time we've ever had it. And it's always been at the end of April. In fact, during the pandemic, it wound up being in August, which was strange because it got postponed and postponed and postponed. And then we just had it align with another election that was happening. But setting aside pandemic year, it's always been toward the end of April, and now we're at the beginning of April. So pretty good run on the primary. What were your impressions of what you saw happening around the state?
So this was the first time that Connecticut did early voting, as we know, and I thought that it was very interesting that over 17,000 voters took part in early voting over 4 days. It made sense to me that Tuesday had the most amount of turnout, with around 6,000 people coming to vote, and I hope that Connecticut continues to increase their early voting numbers as the years goes on.
Of course, the second most popular day was Saturday because it was the last day, so you had the early birds and the procrastinators sort of dominating, and then the in-betweens. I was one of the in-betweens. I wound up voting on Thursday. So I went into my town hall, and it was interesting to me. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I knew what the process was going to be, but there's you get your ballot, of course, and you get an envelope into which it will be sealed, and that is barcoded. They scanned the barcode. I went in, marked my ballot for Joe Biden, and then put it in the envelope. And you sign and date the envelope, and it goes into a container or whatever that is safely stored until election day. Those were then counted on election day. And you're right about the total number of votes, but I believe the Democratic side was about 12,000. That's going to end up representing, I actually didn't do the math on this. We'll have to look at what the percentage is, and I'll be curious to see if our percentage is higher than the Republican.
I thought it was really interesting that the state's largest cities had the lowest turnouts.
Yeah.
Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, and Waterbury all had a turnout rate of less than 1%. And it made me kind of think
to clarify, that's for early voting.
Right.
And right. The turnout was a little healthier for overall, but yeah.
And I think I wonder if that's because maybe voting early, normally in those cities, is more convenient for people, and maybe it's less convenient for more suburban areas.
Hard to know. It's a question of messaging and getting it out there that it is an available option. We actually got 48 votes in the Connecticut Democratic primary from overseas. So there are some people who really bend over backwards to make sure that they're getting their votes in. And if you happen to be one of those listeners, hey, reach out to us at info@ctdems.org. We'd love to hear from you if you're a Democrat abroad. There was a period of time I lived abroad for 4 years and I voted absentee. I don't believe I voted in the presidential primary, though. So the results of the primary were that Joe Biden wound up with about 85% of the Democratic vote, and the uncommitted vote came in second with about 11.5, somewhere in that range statewide. So that was on our side of things. And on the Republican side, you hold on to your hat. You're going to be stunned. You're going to be shocked. I'll break the news to you if you haven't heard. Don't worry. Donald Trump prevailed. Yeah, no. I know. We all thought Haley was going to pull it out, but it turns out she did not. Did you see how well she did, though?
I did see that she did a lot better than I thought she would. I think she got 14% of the vote or something like that, which was honestly really surprising for me because I thought that he would completely sweep.
Sure. I mean, she's not running. On our side, Dean Phillips isn't running, and he was not exactly Mr. Charisma from the beginning. However, he got about 1.5% or something like that. Running against someone who's actually said, please don't vote for me, and people did anyway, I think is a pretty strong message from Republican voters that they're not too happy that Trump is once again at the top of their ticket. Now, if you're a Republican elected official, you're thrilled that Trump is at the top of your ticket. At least they seem to be. I haven't seen anyone push back or rebuke him. I haven't seen George Logan say, I'm upset that Trump won. I didn't say George Logan say, I'm going out and voting for Nikki Haley as a protest vote. I didn't see, I'm certainly not going to see Mike France say that. I didn't see the Senate candidate running against Murphy come out and say anything. Not surprising. We haven't seen the Senate candidate against Murphy come out and say much at all. But It's disheartening. It's disheartening that there aren't more Connecticut Republicans pushing back against this the Trump wave.
To me, it's almost become that Trump isn't really even a candidate anymore. He's more of a set of values and ideas that preys on such a vulnerable group of people. And I think that as we continue to kind of think of him as a person that needs to be defeated and not a phenomenon that needs to be defeated in the minds of people, it's become like an uphill battle that no one's going to win.
We're going to win it here in Connecticut. That I'm sure of. And then when it comes to the states that are in play, we're going to be doing our best to help out in those states. If that's something that sounds great to you, just keep stay tuned to here at Connecticrats as we get opportunities to go to Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and maybe phone bank in other places. That would be wonderful to get a lot of people from Connecticut fired up and going out into the swing states that are going to decide this thing at the presidential level.
Yes, phone banking and canvassing and all that kind of stuff is super important. And there's also a lot of ways to get involved with those kinds of things on the youth side, with the College Democrats of Connecticut and Young Dems of Connecticut as well. I'm sure where they're going to be, we are going to be planning so many events like that in this upcoming fall. I sat down this week with State Treasurer Eric Russell, and we had a very interesting conversation. Take a listen. This week on Connecticrats, we are joined with Eric Russell, Connecticut State Treasurer, to discuss his role in the state, his advice for young people and voters, and baby bonds. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks, Tara. Very happy to be here with you.
We had on you on earlier when you were a candidate for treasurer. How does your experience in the job match the expectations you had when you decided to run?
So in many ways, it's really exceeded my expectations. As you probably recall, I professionally was an attorney by trade in the public and private finance space before running for office. And I did a lot of work with the treasurer's office. So there was a lot of the role that I was really familiar with. And that was definitely helpful in transitioning in and really knowing what to expect in many ways. But, you know, I think I underestimated how rewarding it's been to work with such a really talented and dedicated team of people in the office. True public servants that could be off doing a lot of different things and have really been committed to the state. And just the real opportunity to make some change in the state, to really continue the progress that we've made in terms of improving our overall fiscal health, but really look for opportunities to also make sure that we're building a future in Connecticut that we really want to see that's more full of opportunity, that has more people participating in the process. And so it's been incredibly rewarding already, and I'm excited about the work that remains to be done.
If there's one thing you'd like the average voter to know about your role, what would that be?
Good question, because that was probably the most common question I got during the campaign is, we know the treasurer's role involves money, but, you know, what's the day-to-day like? What are some of the other responsibilities? I would say really just to understand the impact of the role. I think when thinking about the treasurer's office, it's not the one that's always gotten the most attention. It's not always viewed as being kind of the sexiest gig in politics, but it has a huge impact on people in our state. It's really about thinking about the future. It's about investing in the future. Again, making sure that our state is positioned well from a fiscal standpoint. That we are investing in people, that we're investing in the future. And, you know, it's a long-term role. A lot of other positions in government and in politics are thinking about, you know, a 1 or 2 year budget cycle, or, you know, the next election 2 years down the road. A lot of the decisions that are made in this office are really about the future. They're investment decisions or policy decisions that won't really bear fruit until sometimes 5, 7, 10 years down the road. And I think what's unique about that is it positions me to really think about what we want the long-term future of the state to look like. And so I've been excited to collaborate with the legislature, with the governor, with my fellow constitutional officers, really focused on policy that is going to make sure we're better positioned decades down the road, and that we're not passing on a lot of the challenges and liabilities that you and I kind of inherited as young people in the state.
How do you think the average voter can make a difference in Connecticut?
So I think it's about being involved. And I think whatever that involvement may look like, right? I mean, running for office is not for everyone. frankly, I never saw myself running for office either. But I think there are a lot of other ways to be involved and to make an impact, whether it's in community organizations and things like that in your community, making people aware of how to participate and be involved, making sure people are voting and speaking up for issues that are important to them, engaging with your elected officials on the local, state, and federal level, understanding that if issues are being brought to them and elected officials know that things that are happening and that policy is important to you and your community, that they're going to be paying attention, and that's how you ultimately get these things done. Because it's ultimately about building momentum around things that are important to people. And, you know, in thinking about a lot of my role, when you talk about fiscal policy, when you talk about big economic policy, a lot of times it's hard to build that momentum because we are used to kind of keeping things as they are. And it's not what most people are paying attention to on a day-to-day basis. But I think with certain programs and initiatives that we've been able to get accomplished, baby bonds being one big example of that, it would not have happened without a lot of collaboration and involvement and people really stressing the need to build a fairer and more equitable economy in our state. And that's ultimately what leads to making big things happen.
I know you're a young person in politics yourself, but what advice would you give a young person who wants to pursue a career in politics?
I would say just do it, right? It's not, you know, I think we've for a long time had this mindset that everyone has to wait their turn and has to be invited to the table or has to be kind of handed something before you can step up. And I think a lot of it is about, again, getting involved, building relationships, seeking out opportunities, letting people know you're interested, just doing the work, right? I mean, what you, regardless of how insignificant some role or volunteering or making phone calls may seem, you know, what I think anyone in this space is really looking at are people who are passionate about the work and that are willing to put the work in. And so I would say just go after it. And when there are opportunities for you to run, if that's something that you want to do, step up and do it. We need more young people at the table. We need your voices reflected in politics, because again, as we think about a lot of these long-term initiatives that I'm talking about, it's going to be my generation, your generation, the one after ours that is most impacted by a lot of these decisions. And it's what we're seeing now. You know, I'm responsible for our pension funds. We went about 70 years without really doing what we were supposed to do on that front. And it's our generations that are paying for that now. Knowing that if we have more young people at the table who are thinking about the future, who are really going to be impacted by some of these decisions, it's going to, I think it will inform policy moving forward. And the last thing I'll say is just don't feel uncomfortable taking up space. I think for a lot of young people, it's intimidating coming into these environments. It's intimidating being around elected officials and people with titles, right? But you belong in these rooms too, and you have a voice and your perspective is important, and policy and issues that are important to you are important to a lot of other people. And so when you have those opportunities to speak up and weigh in, make sure to maximize them and know that that's what you should be doing.
I'm so glad that you mentioned pension funds, because I recently read that in 2023, Connecticut's pension funds earned returns of 12.8%, making the state among the top 27% of public pension funds across the state. This is a dramatic improvement from Connecticut's pension funds having been among the worst performing in the nation prior to your term. What has changed, and what are you doing to continue this progress?
Sure, great question, and thank you for bringing that up. You know, this is not just a one-year thing. As we look at our pension fund performance and where we are, we have to think about this big picture. A lot of times changes that are being made, they really take time to implement and for us to see the benefits of those changes. We've done a lot of work since coming into office, but this has really been several years in the making. Many changes that were made under my predecessor, Treasurer Wooden. But it's also about the fact that we are finally fully funding our pensions and actually paying into. We've made nearly $8 billion in additional contributions into our pension funds in recent years. And what that allows us to do is maximize those funds and this opportunity to make sure that we're protecting pensioners, state employees and teachers and retirees in their retirement security. And so again, we've made a lot of changes, the biggest one being asset allocation. That was something that started back in 2022 before I came into office. And then since coming in, we've really been doing work to right-size the portfolio. We passed legislation working in collaboration with the legislature to make sure we can recruit and retain top-tier investment talent to build on the talent that we have in the office. We made some changes to our investment advisory council to make sure we can bring really seasoned experienced investors on the investment advisory council. And then we're doing a lot of work in terms of reviewing managers and streamlining the portfolio, trying to reduce the number of managers that we're using, reduce the amount of fees that we're paying. So all of these things are happening, and we have a lot more work ahead of us. While this 1 year number is great and it's really strong, we've actually had a couple of strong years back to back now. What I really care about is building this so that we can have long-term sustained success. In this industry, we are really looking at having strong performance over market cycles. So, you know, this 5 to 10 year windows are really what we're more focused on. What I think this year's performance shows is that many of the changes that we're making are really moving us in the right direction. And so I'm excited about the opportunity that's ahead.
What do you think makes Connecticut's financial management unique and different from other states?
So I'd say in recent years, one of the things that is has been biggest, and I know it's an issue that there's a lot of conversation about right now, but it's been the fiscal guardrails, right? It's been this broad-based support to really address a lot of the longstanding challenges we've had after going many years not doing what we were supposed to do, and really kicking the can down the road to future generations, as I mentioned earlier. In recent years, what we've done is, you know, through sound budgeting practices, we have made sure, you know, and under strong leadership from the governor and the legislature, passing sound budgets that are balanced. We have a full rainy day fund, so upwards of $3 billion in our rainy day fund, which positions us well in the event that there's a downturn or there's volatility in the market, that we're able to withstand that. As I mentioned, we paid down nearly $8 billion in additional contributions to our pension liabilities. And what that does is free up upwards of $600 million annually out of our general fund that would be going toward paying contributions into our pension fund. And that savings over 25 plus years moving forward. So it's really been this strong commitment to addressing these longstanding challenges and making sure that we are making sound fiscal decisions. And, you know, I always say this, from our party perspective, I think that the other side often tries to take credit for being the party of fiscal responsibility. And I think after many decades of mismanagement as a state, and frankly, with blame on both sides, it really has been strong Democratic leadership under Democratic governors that have led us to this point where we are. And so, you know, through my office, I'm committed to maintaining that. What this allows us to do, you know, I manage our credit relationships with rating agencies. Improving our fiscal health has improved our credit rating dramatically, which allows us to continue to invest in our community at the lowest cost to taxpayers, allows us to borrow at the lowest rate, at lower rates for taxpayers. And so we need to continue the work that we're doing and find that balance between, you know, having sound fiscal policy while still investing in people in our state. And I think, you know, we're in a strong position to do that moving forward.
I know that baby bonds are a policy that you've worked a lot on and that is really important to you, and that required a lot of relentless advocacy. So I really want to ask, what are baby bonds exactly and how do they work?
Sure. And then thank you for bringing this up. This certainly was a long process and a lot of work in the making, but I think anytime you're doing big innovative things, right, it takes time and it takes collaboration. And I think through a lot of that collaboration, we landed at a really strong policy and ended up financing it in the way that was best. But, you know, big picture here, baby bonds is a first in the nation program that's ultimately it's aimed at addressing cycles of generational poverty in our state. Connecticut is one of the wealthiest states in the country, but it has one of the largest wealth gaps. And it is a wealth gap that has continued to widen over time. And so what baby bonds is the goal is to help those born into poverty build wealth over time. And so for now in Connecticut, starting as of July 1st of 2023, any child who was born into poverty, which we use that child's birth being covered by Husky as the qualifier, there will be $3,200 that's invested in a trust on behalf of that child. And that money will grow over the life of that individual. And when they are between the ages of 18 and 30, they can access those resources for initiatives that are all about wealth building. So they can use those funds to help purchase a home here in Connecticut, to start or invest in a Connecticut business, to help pay for post-secondary education or job training, or to roll into a retirement savings account. And when you think about, you know, the goal here, right? I mean, I grew up in New Haven, between New Haven and West Haven. A lot of the folks in my community, you know, never owned a home. They went to work every day. They worked really hard to make ends meet, paid rent every month. But the difference between them being able to own something and have an asset that would actually grow in value over time was having some access to capital to start with, to put down a down payment. And so that's what this program is aimed to do, is to help those who are born in these cycles to have that little bit of assistance to really pull themselves up in a meaningful way and change their circumstance in a meaningful way. And really creating that hope for children who may be born in some of these spaces where it's really hard to imagine a future that's different than what you've seen. Know that there are these opportunities out there. And so, yeah, I'm really excited about this program. We're still doing a lot of work to not only look at the access to capital 18 plus years down the road, but engagement with these children and their families along the way, what additional wraparound supports we can build into the program to give folks in our state the best opportunity moving forward. And knowing that when more people have that opportunity, when more people are participating in a meaningful way, it's going to benefit all of us and really the future of Connecticut, building a stronger economy where, you know, more people can participate and thrive. And that's really the goal of this program. And, you know, I think that's important that we keep that perspective as we're thinking about policy in our state more broadly.
I know that financial education is something that's really inaccessible. So I was wondering if you had any plans or ideas to help Connecticut citizens learn more about financial management and responsibility.
I'm glad you brought this up, because April is actually Financial Literacy Month, so it's a perfect time to kick it off and talk about it a little bit. You know, we do a lot of work in the office around financial literacy, and we have a lot of partners in that. I think the goal here is certainly to expand it, and it's to tie it into more of the things that we're already doing. As I mentioned, with the Baby Bonds program, financial literacy course is actually a requirement for access to those resources down the road. And so that's a piece there. We know, you know, in folks getting this access to capital, we want to make sure that it's maximized and used in the best way possible. Kudos to Connecticut again, which last session, there was legislation passed that actually made financial education a requirement for graduation for all freshmen entering high school in 2023. And so I think we need to continue to talk about how we can really build financial education into more of what we're doing. The goal is to have young folks thinking about financial education earlier, learning a lot of the basics, because the reality is financial education is a lifelong endeavor. It's not something where you ever you know, you learn a few things and then you're done. These are skills and knowledge that we all can use every single day in our lives, and that we can continue to build on. And if we have, you know, constituents and residents in our state that know more about how to manage their resources and their finances, that know some of the basics around financial education, that we're all going to be better off for it. And so we're going to continue to do that outreach and work with partners. And really get out in the community to spread the importance of financial education and to try to maximize opportunities for people to access it as well.
That's amazing. And kind of moving back towards Baby Bonds, and considering that this program is so revolutionary, are you hearing from other state treasurers to ask about our legislation and the program? And do you hope to inspire other states to follow suit?
Certainly. So we're working very closely with several other states right now. Vermont, I was there as they rolled out legislation under the leadership of Treasurer Pichek. And so they are moving things along in Vermont. Massachusetts is looking at legislation, Rhode Island. I'm also in touch with several other states across the country that are in the early stages of exploring this. And so it's really exciting. I think, you know, as we, again, Connecticut leading the way, and I give so much credit to everyone involved in this, the legislature, the Black and Puerto Rican caucus, especially the governor, obviously Treasurer Wooden, who spearheaded the start of much of the work around baby bonds and getting legislation passed in Connecticut. And so it was a team effort. And I think it says a lot about our commitment to the future. And it's exciting to see other states who are committed to this work as well. And I think it's important, you know, we talk about the social benefit of this program and the people who are going to be impacted. But I think what has been really made this effective and the reason a lot of other states are excited about it is it's not just a social policy. It's also an economic policy for our state. These are all resources that are going to be reinvested right back here in Connecticut as people are purchasing homes and starting businesses. I think, you know, we got a lot of support from the business community who understood that this would be lead to more skilled workers and trained workers in the state. And just big picture, in order to access these resources, you have to be a Connecticut resident. And so the goal here is that, you know, even if there are children who may move out of the state at some point throughout their life, this is an incentive for people to come back to Connecticut, start their careers, start their families, purchase their homes in our state, really leading to more people living in our state and contributing long term. And so it's an exciting opportunity. We're also seeing some conversation around this on the federal level, which was pushed by Senator Cory Booker and Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. And so it's an exciting, again, exciting policy. And I think there's going to be a lot more conversation about this down the road.
And lastly, what do you think is the biggest financial or fiscal threat that Connecticut faces in the coming years? And what ideas do you have to protect the state?
Great question. You know, I think, again, we are well positioned because of a lot of the sound policy decisions being made by the legislature and the governor right now. And I think it's important that we don't lose sight of, while things are very good right now and we're sitting on reserves, that, you know, the reason for those reserves being there is not when things are going well. It's that at some point we are going to hit some volatility and some downturns. We've seen across the country where, you know, revenues, tax revenues coming into states are starting to slow down. And so we just want to be mindful of that. So I think it's more about, you know, one of the big things is not losing sight of kind of the long-term investment here by making sound fiscal decisions. And then the last thing I would say is just really addressing a lot of our longstanding challenges and our pension fund really being at the core of that. While we've made a lot of progress in paying down pension debt, we're obviously doing a lot of work to make sure we're maximizing the dollars in our pension fund from a performance perspective. We need to remain committed to making our required contributions and having these additional funds going into the pension fund where we can, because once we get, you know, this is just, again, saving taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars long term. And while we, you know, while we've made progress, we're not there yet. It takes a long time to dig yourself out of a 70-year plus hole. And so we need to stay committed to that. And make sure that, you know, we're not passing these obligations on to future generations as was done previously. So big picture, you know, I think we are in a really strong position. I think we're at a place where we can balance the need to address these potential challenges while still investing in people, investing in education and childcare, many of the important things that we need for the future of the state. And I think, you know, we're going to be in a good spot moving forward.
Thank you so much, Treasurer, for joining us on this episode of Connecticrats. It was amazing to hear your financial insights and ideas, and we hope to speak with you again sometime soon.
I appreciate it, Tara.
That was fantastic. And I've seen Eric Russell over the years because for a while he was vice chair of the Connecticut Democratic Party. So I, you know, interacted with Eric all the time, and it was fantastic that he ran and won. And now when I go and check my kids' 529 plans, the college savings plans, I log on to the site and there's Eric's face at the top of my web browser, like looking back at me, and I'm hearing his voice on the podcast. It's really fantastic to see him and to hear from him this week.
It was an awesome interview and he had so many incredible insights, and I'm incredibly excited to see what he's going to be doing in the future.
Yeah, we like Eric a lot. There've been some good articles lately about the pension performance of Connecticut's investments that he's been stewarding for the last year or so. And it's yet another one of these Connecticut comeback turnaround stories where now we're starting to see that our Democratic elected officials are absolutely firing on all cylinders, and Connecticut is growing, and our pensions obligations are getting chipped away at and coming down and down and down, which frees up a lot more money year over year over year. It's nothing but a financial success story.
It was awesome to hear him talk about kind of the back end of recovering from something like that and how a little bit of smartness and managing finances and stuff really makes all the difference for the state.
Yeah, I'm always so impressed with the people who step forward to run. And, you know, in the coming weeks, more and more people will be filing to run in this year's election. We've got, you know, state reps and state Senate seats all over the state. Every Monday, I check the SEEK filings, because that's what I do, and see who has filed in what districts. And the rosters are starting to fill up. If it's something you want to get involved with at your local level, please do, by all means. But those races are sort of the bench, right? Those are sort of the people who become candidates for controller or lieutenant governor. You know, you look at who was in the state legislature. Controller Scanlon was in the state legislature. Attorney General Tong was in the state legislature. Senator Murphy was in the state legislature. Congressman Courtney was in the state legislature. It's a place where it all gets going and where it all starts.
Right. And like Eric said, you just need to jump headfirst in and make the changes that you would want to make. And it's all about being proactive about your political journey. And I think it's such a great thing that we can all choose to run at any point.
Now, there were a number of people who took that plunge to become the president of the United States on the Republican side. As we mentioned before, of course, in the primary, they've all been wiped out. But there was a time not long ago when we did a podcast and we predicted how long people like Vivek Ramaswamy, Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, and others would last. Well, we overestimated them. We overestimated nearly all of them. And interestingly, we underestimated, or at least I underestimated Nikki Haley. I thought she was going to drop before Super Tuesday. She made it to Super Tuesday. So let's listen back to some of those predictions right now. Here was what we thought about Vivek Ramaswamy.
I think he drops out before the convention, but he makes it through Super Tuesday. He's self-funding, so money is not an issue for him.
I think he's been getting a lot of attention lately, so I think he might try to push himself to D, but I agree with what Mike's saying as well.
Yeah, I'm going to go with D as well. Take delegates to the convention. Well, we thought he would make it to the convention. Did he make it to the convention?
Absolutely not.
No. And now every Tuesday is sycophant Tuesday for him. He just sort of sucks up to Donald Trump, hoping to get that cabinet position. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, I think it's really funny because this year I felt like everyone who wasn't Trump's entire campaign was about hating on Trump and not really building a brand and a message for themselves. And it's interesting to see them all now flip back and rejoin right with the cancer. So
it will break my heart a little if Nikki Haley does it. It's the weird thing of like, I've come to expect nothing from these other candidates after like Rubio and Cruz and the others all fell in line and sing Trump's praises after telling the truth about him when they were his opponents. So far, Haley hasn't bent, and I hope she doesn't. Here's what we thought about Nikki Haley's prospects. This was back in, I think, September, October last year.
I feel like she has the experience to take herself to the convention. I think she could go there, but I think she also might drop out before the convention.
I would say that she drops out before Super Tuesday, but the exact time of that is dependent on if Tim Scott drops out and lets her, you know, win South Carolina.
I think Trump carries South Carolina by a million points with Haley and Scott still in the race, absolutely humiliating them because that's his favorite thing to do. So I think she's out before Super Tuesday. Do you think she has a future in Republican politics after this campaign?
I think that judging by the front runners against Trump, any other election that he's been a part of, I don't think that she probably has a future in the Republican Party unless the party finally decides to give up the whole Trump thing and heads in a different direction.
I suppose if you look across decades, right, the nature of political parties does evolve and change. The Republicanism of Eisenhower was quite different from the Republicanism of Reagan. Similarly, The Democratic Party, let's face it, the rural South used to be a Democratic stronghold, and now it is not. And as such, are the things we back and support and the things that we advocate have evolved and changed over time. So maybe in a generation or, 25, 30 years down the road, we'll see something different and something more recognizable to those of us who have been around as the Republican Party. Maybe that's the case. But right now, it doesn't look like that's anywhere on the horizon to me. All right. Talk about an old school Republican, Mike Pence. He's the last of a dying breed of sort of the uptight conservative based in a view of religion that I don't share. Was that polite? Was that the most polite way I could have said that?
I think that was the most politically correct way you could have put that.
I believe I've thrown this out there on the podcast before, but I find it freaking amazing. Mike Pence and Woody Harrelson were in a Bible study class together at college. That is a true fact, and I find it absolutely amazing. That has no bearing on this discussion, but I want to get that fact in every chance I get. So here's what we thought about Pence and how far he might go in the Republican nominating process this year.
Very bad representative of all the Mikes of the world. I think he's gone before Iowa.
Gotta say, former vice presidents usually do well. This one will not. I'm going to think he deludes himself into believing he's going to rock Iowa. And there'll be Pence mentum pushing him through the next set of primaries, but he's dead wrong, and he'll drop out actually before New Hampshire, which by our metrics is B before Super Tuesday. But I don't even think he's going to make New Hampshire.
I feel like there are some people that would side with Pence, but because Pence isn't really as much affiliated with Trump anymore, I feel like he's lost a lot of the Trump's base of support that he may have had otherwise.
Yeah, I think it was pretty clear that Mike Pence didn't really have too far to go there. And it is nice, at least, that he's the one who is repudiating Trump after the fact and not endorsing and not supporting. So we'll give him on a 10-star scale, I'll give him 1 star. I mean, 1 star for that. And that leaves sad Ron DeSantis. Has anyone's sort of profile suffered more from running for president than Ron DeSantis's?
Ron DeSanctimonious is one of my favorite Republican candidates.
You did it. You pulled it out of the thin air. There it is, Ron DeSanctimonious. It works.
And it's kind of incredible when I think about him, because I think his rivalry with Trump really demonstrates to me just how powerful Trump is and the way that he uses language and how he really infiltrates people's minds, because I genuinely cannot hear Ron DeSantis's name anymore without thinking of Ron DeSanctimonious. And I'm not even sure if Trump knows what DeSanctimonious even means, but
that's the thing. He can't be sure. That's right. Someone pitched it to him. He's like, that sounds good. Let's hear what we had to say about Ron's chances in the primary.
I feel like he's not going to last long. I think he had a lot of hype in the beginning, but I think it's just been kind of falling apart as the months have been going on.
Do you think he makes it to Iowa or Super Tuesday or A or B?
I would say B, probably.
I'm going to be bold here. I'm going to go with A. I think he's the Scott Walker of 2024. Look it up, kids.
Yeah, I don't think he makes it to Super Tuesday. I mean, he's going to need a lot of money is a problem for him. He's going to need a lot of Greenwich fundraisers to sustain the type of campaign you need for a guy who's not that good at retail politics. He needs to be up on TV, and that's very costly.
All right, so in some cases, we absolutely overestimated the ability, the staying power of some of these folks. And on the other side, we sold Nikki Haley a little bit short, at least I did, and I'll cop to that. There were, of course, other people running, like Doug Burgum, and I can't even remember, but there were a number of others, one of whom was named Ryan Binkley. And when I pitched that one to Mike and Travis back on the last show, they didn't believe that was a real person. I would like to say that in Killingly, Connecticut, Ryan Binkley got 16% of the vote. It may be his high watermark anywhere in the country. Killingly, Connecticut is Binkley country.
I have to be honest, I think that you're making him up too.
That's absolutely fair. It sounds a little bit like the character from, what was a cartoon with Bloom County? There was a character named Binkley, and all I could think of was maybe it's just the guy from Bloom. Maybe it's a cartoon character. I have no idea.
Entirely possible.
So with the primary behind us, the remainder of April and May, there's a lot of organizing going on within the party. All the Democratic town committees all elected new chairs this past for the next 2 years. And that was all done in March and the first week of April. So we got new chairs in a lot of towns. A lot of people get reelected to their chairmanships of local town committees. But the local town committees are really the building block of the Democratic Party. If you think about the DNC, Democratic National Committee. Well, there's state committees. That's what the CT Dems are. And then there's town committees in every single town. So that's a great way to get involved, to reach out to these new chairs and get involved in your town committees.
Yeah, I think it's really disheartening that there's so much focus on national politics that we forget how much local politics is impactful and influential. And getting involved with it in any way that you can is such a great way to work towards positive change in a more tangible way than just voting in the presidential elections.
When I first became involved, it was because my aunt was actually mayor of a town for a while. And so I called her up. I said, how do you do this? How do you get a foot in the door? What do you do? She said, go to your local town committee meeting.
It's interesting that you mentioned getting started in the town committee, because my first involvement with politics was in my town committee back in New Jersey. And what's very interesting about the small town where I'm from is that we have a separate deer management council that is just as powerful as the town committee is. So most of my memories from high school going to the town committee meetings was the people on that board fighting with the deer management committee, because deer overpopulation was such an issue.
I have to stop you. The deer management committee
Yes.
was as powerful as the local government that does taxing and spending and runs the schools, etc. So there was managing the schools, managing the fire and police departments, managing snow plowing and garbage pickup, but then equal the deer management committee.
You would only understand if you're from Montgomery, New Jersey, and you just walk around and you see 10 to 20 deer anywhere that you go.
I gotta tell you, there's probably a lot of places in Connecticut where if there were a deer management committee, it would be a powerhouse local organization. And just to bring it back, if there were, and I don't think there are, that's exactly the kind of thing the Democrat and Republican town committees would be appointing people to. So please do get involved at the local level. That's going to do it for this episode of Connecticrats, the CT Dems podcast. We will see you next week.
See you next week.